You might know Jonathan Van Ness from Queer Eye. I do. My God, the Queer Eye reboot on Netflix is fantastic. But did you know he also has a podcast called Getting Curious, and it's available right here on Earwolf? On Getting Curious, Jonathan explores anything and everything under the sun, from saving bees to learning how to do triple axels. I'm not saying I'm an expert in those two things, but I can hold my own, except I cannot. After you're done binge-watching season two of Queer Eye, get to know a different side of Jonathan's co-stars, and Jonathan himself, I guess, with special episodes that feature Anthony, Karamo, and Tan. Subscribe to Getting Curious now wherever you listen. That could be Apple Podcasts. It could be Stitcher. I don't care what app you're using. I just want you to listen to the newest, greatest Jonathan Van Ness podcast right here on Earwolf, Getting Curious. Thanks. Welcome to The Wolf Den, the podcast about the business and people of podcasting. I'm your host, Lex Friedman. Today, our guest is Stuart Last, the Chief Operating Officer at Audioboom. We're going to learn more about Stuart Last later on, but first, let's talk about shows we're jealous of, where we highlight shows we like so much, we wish we made them ourselves. Stuart, do you have a show you're jealous of?
Yeah, it's something I got turned onto just a couple of weeks ago, actually. It's a show called Danny in the Valley.
I don't know it.
It's a show that comes out of the Sunday Times in the UK, but Danny is, he's an American, lives on the West Coast.
Oh, it's a business. The worst.
Well, only because I'm so jealous of anyone that lives on the West Coast.
Of course.
Yeah. It's a tech and business show. He's there in Silicon Valley and covering some great topics. And then every now and then, just a massive guest drops by. So it's Richard Branson, or it's Steve Ballmer, or it's Bill Gates.
And
these guests drop by, they talk about great business and tech subjects. And this just flies under the radar, you know. It needs to be a bigger show. We'd love to work with Danny on that.
That's amazing. I noticed when I was commuting into the city this morning that the segment is called Shows We're Jealous Of. And today I'm not even using a podcast. That's how much I break the rules. And this is totally in keeping with the kinds of shows I recommended here before. We talked at one point to the folks who made A Very Fatal Murder for The Onion.
Yeah.
And I clearly have learned now that I'm a fan of true crime, parody, and satire. And there's a show on Netflix that kept getting recommended to me that's clearly a parody of true crime podcast, just done in documentary video form. It's also mocking like Making a Murder on Netflix, but it's a show called American Vandal.
I started watching that.
I had just kept hearing about it. I really didn't know what it was, didn't know what kind of comedy it was, and I turned it on just a few days ago, and like the crime that they're investigating, we can swear on this show, right, Harry? Harry says yes. The crime that they're investigating is that some student at the high school has spray painted phalluses. I didn't even swear, onto all the cars of the teachers in the parking lot. Now, my parents, my older parents are visiting, and so I was like, let's find something to watch on Netflix. So watching people talk continually about the dicks and the drawings of the dicks and trying to identify whether those dicks have been drawn in such a way as to incriminate one graffiti artist or another. It was a lot with my parents, but it's like a near pitch perfect serial parody. They even talk about serial in episode 3. Yeah. So I'm going to recommend that too.
Cool. That show, I've seen the first episode, just reminds me of life in London when it snows, right? Because it doesn't snow very often in London, not like it does here in New York. Maybe once every couple of years. When it does, every car in the city has a dick drawn
really?
On it in the snow. Yeah,
I had no idea.
It always happens. So yeah, you can't walk along a street without seeing at least 5 dicks.
Listen, there's...
Which is a quote you're going to pull out, right?
Yes.
Yeah, good.
I was going to say, there should no... People listen to The Wolf Den for 2 things, podcast insights, and they want to know about dicks in London. So I'm glad we got that covered. But you're here, so you're I'm going to let it go. All right. Well, Stuart, again, you're the Chief Operating Officer at Audioboom. How'd you get started in audio?
I started in audio maybe 18 years ago now. My first job was in BBC Radio in London.
I've heard of it.
At BBC Radio 1, which is just this incredible radio station, really influential, has been breaking new music and bands since the 1960s. Just this fantastic spirit of kind of finding and championing new music. I started there 2001, working on The Breakfast Show, kind of graduated through there, spent 10 years of my life at Radio 1, working up to producer level, just the most fun. And, you know, it's a radio station that is unfortunately struggling a bit right now just because it's no longer that place to break music. You know, it's now competing against Spotify and YouTube and everywhere else.
Right. And then at some point in 2011, you moved from BBC Radio 1 to BBC 2, right?
Yeah.
Is that an upgrade?
it's just a it just has a different audience. So Radio 1 is kind of the youth channel, so targeted at under 35s. Radio 2 is the 35 through to 70 year old radio station.
Did you move when you were changing? Like, was it staying in line?
It was the right time. So I could not go to any more gigs. I could not spend any more time in these dark, smoky, dingy venues watching music gigs. So it was the right time to go. And, you know, Radio 2 is just huge. Biggest radio station in Europe. You know, 15 million people tune into that radio station every day.
Wow. That's as many people as listen to the Wolf Den. So that's a lot.
Exactly. So you guys are doing pretty well then. And I went there to kind of lead on their digital strategy. So, you know, Radio 1, great digital strategy, already fully on social and we're driving things through there. Radio 2, just different audience, didn't know what Facebook was, didn't know what Twitter was, didn't have any of those connections with the audience. So went there, built out a podcast strategy and a social media strategy for those guys. Really kind of good couple of years before I moved here to the US.
And when you came to the U.S., did you come for Block Talk Radio or did you come to the U.S. first and then Block Talk Radio came after?
No, I mean, I'd love to say I came for Block Talk Radio, but I think that would have been a huge step to do that. I came here because my wife works in TV and she came over to work at BBC America, the cable channel. Now she's moved on to work at Viacom and Paramount. But I kind of I came over and had 9 months off when I came here due to visa issues. I got to spend 9 months in New York just kind of hanging out and seeing the city and making friends.
It's nice working
and, it was a good time. Although I arrived on January the 2nd, I think, and it was the worst winter that we've had for a long time. So I was kind of stuck in an apartment all alone for a while. Blog Talk Radio was a good step into, you know, next step into the podcast industry, especially here in the US where it's so much more mature. And even back then, in 2012, 2013, it was so much more mature than the industry in the UK. I'd been there kind of 6 to 8 months and the guys at Audio Boom wanted to launch the company in the US. They called me up and we launched mid-2014. I've been here almost 4 years now.
And did you know some of the Audio Boom folks before you came to the
US? Yeah, I'd worked with them when I was working at the BBC. We had this great documentary series and it was basically, we were basically crowdsourcing audio about defining songs from each year from the last 40 years. And Audio Boom has, and did back then in particular, was a tech platform. And it allowed you to very easily and quickly crowdsource audio. Just you'd send out a link, the audience would click on a record button on their desktop or on their phone. They could record straight into their phone or their desktop. That piece of audio would just be transferred straight to the production team at Radio 2 as an MP3. They'd build it into the documentary. So it was a great kind of audio gathering tool as well back then.
That's awesome. And so you started at Audio Boom in 2014.
Yeah.
As GM and SVP.
Yes.
And then 2 years later, they're like, no. This is Stuart Last. He should be our chief operating officer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, things went pretty quickly here, I think.
That seems to be happening across podcasting.
We were, you know, again, the
I was hired as the custodian here at Midroll.
Oh, yeah?
No. But it would have been a good story.
It would have been. And that would have been quite a remarkable piece of growth for you as well. We very quickly kind of changed our business model a little bit when we launched in the US. In the UK, we'd been this tech platform for kind of gathering and sharing short form audio.
Right.
Then we'd extended out to work with the radio industry, creating kind of a platform for radio stations to do on-demand versions of their shows. But in the US, when I kind of launched it here, it was very clear that it was the podcast space and the original content podcast space that was kind of growing very quickly. And we launched, you know, a couple of months before Serial. So it was a great time to do that. So, very quickly set up shop here, brought in a small at first, but very great team and kind of, grew the podcast part to what we do. So much so that, you know, it became a setup where 90% of our business was coming out of the US very, very quickly after launch. We just needed the team here to take things forward for the company. And it's been really great because, you know, with the industry so far ahead here, all of the learnings from here, we can just push back to our team in the UK, our team in India, and our team in Australia and let them go do their thing.
Now, Audioboom obviously has made a lot of news recently. Yeah. We're going to get into all of it. But I want to – you talked about how it started as a tech company, especially in the UK. How do you describe it now? What's the – not even the elevator pitch, but the elevator description of what is Audioboom today? How do you explain what you are?
So today we're content and services around that. So, you know, the big push from us in this year and next year and beyond is original content. Mm-hmm. Again, when I launched Audioboom here, it was always with that view of we would become that content creator. Everyone in the company has a an editorial program making background. You know, my time at the BBC, Brendan, who's my head of content, worked at MTV Radio for years. We all kind of come wanting to make content and wanting to make programs. It just took 2 or 3 years to get to that point. Sure. As we grew the business. So that's very much the focus, I think, for the future. Right now, the main service that we offer is ad sales representation of independent podcasts and third-party networks.
So right now, you're still selling ads for third-party shows as well?
Yeah.
So, including for some of the shows from our most recent guests from Casper.
Castbox, we are the exclusive sales rep of other big shows in our network. The guys at Case File that you guys used to work closely with.
Is that nice?
Oh, I think we are...
I mean, I could list shows that have gone in both directions, but I guess.
Hey, that we are, us, yourselves, a few others... kind of friendly competitors, and
right.
Shows are, and I think it's probably something we'll get onto as we go. Shows are currently kind of seeing independent shows are kind of garnering a little more power as talent agents in LA and New York kind of come into this business and start to empower them to go and seek better deals. And that's where, and that's why shows are moving between networks semi-quickly, I would say, at this point, right? And, that's when us and you guys and others all get competitive and shows do move.
And it's it leads to a question that, I get that there's some irony in my asking you this, but as Audioboom says, we are quickly evolving into being a content company where we have, you said, everybody on staff's got an editorial mindset. You are looking to make more and more original shows. Why keep the ad sales in-house? Meaning it's like... it's a challenge in middle class too, right? But like if your focus is let's make great shows, why is it important to have the monetization in-house and have to build up that staff and that expertise, which is so wildly different from making great content?
Yeah, I kind of come at it almost the other way around, which is how do you build a creative content company in the same office space and the same building as an ad sales
as
operation?
The soul-sucking capitalist on the ad sales side, right?
Exactly, and that's actually the more difficult part. I mean, you keep the ad sales part because you've already grown that as much as anything, and it's already driving your business forward and has a great kind of a flow of cash coming through it. Creating, a space, a studio space, a production facility where you can truly kind of, you can get creative, you can brainstorm, you can develop ideas, free of the drive of the ad sales part of the business is very difficult. And I think with that, we have a studio space in New York that does share, the same building as our big ad sales team, but we will, over the course of that next 2 years, take some of that production out to Los Angeles and open a production facility and studios there as well. Just to kind of to do two things, I think, to separate and kind of help create that, creative team function, and also to just tap into the talent that's in LA, both on-air talent and production talent and writing talent too.
And so... I want to get to all that newsy stuff, but a couple more questions on this, the kind of the questions that everybody in our space talks about all the time. Talk to me first about your take on ad sales or on ad delivery. Midroll pretty much exclusively does host reads. Is that the same place where Audioboom is now? And do you think the ad format's going to change? What are your thoughts on programmatic? All the standard podcast ad questions.
Yeah. I mean, I think
you have
12
seconds. We're
we could probably be here 12 hours, right?
But yes.
I mean, I think we're in a similar place to you. The majority of our ads are host endorsed, baked into the content. Occasionally the host endorsed are dynamically inserted if they're targeted into different regions. We have a tech setup that allows us to tap into various automated ad networks. But again, what's coming out of there in the main is 30-second radio spots that sound terrible in podcasts.
Are you taking them right now or no?
We're taking them on some shows.
So they sound terrible, but we're using them sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, they don't run on our Audioboom originals. They generally don't run on our kind of top 100 network where we're selling premium sales.
But it's backfill for shows with lower expectations on revenue.
Yeah, lower expectations just, someone that just wants to cover costs as much as anything, enthusiast creator level shows that just want to cover the costs of what they do, and they're kind of open to it. So we do have that. It's a relatively small part of the business, but I see that as an automated tech solution and kind of not too much more than that. Where do I see it going? We have more and more branding advertisers coming in, and we're seeing, we're on proposals all the time there, and more money coming in from the big mature ad agencies that want to do branding campaigns. I'm sure you guys are seeing the same.
Sure.
Again, still host endorsed and still kind of baked into the content, so it's going to be very difficult to take that and run anything across a network. It's still going to be a heavy lift to sell the advertising. It's still going to require a big sales team and a big sales support team. But the good thing with that is that I think it creates a longer term relationship between shows and the advertiser, because they are not going to be kind of judging you on the conversion rate for your audience buying meal kits when they're hearing the same ad on 500 other podcasts, right?
And so every DR advertiser, the ones who are giving out offer codes and tracking that way, your Blue Apron, ZipRecruiter, Squarespace, all of those companies. That's exactly my point, is that all of those companies know that even though they're trying to measure a direct response, there is a branding element to all advertising too, mm-hmm. right? You don't always need to find a web hosting platform. So just having Squarespace in the back of your mind, even if you only use the offer code once, the fact that you've heard it for 9 months before you finally buy a website, that's the branding component of their campaign. I would say the biggest challenge that we had was getting branding advertisers over the hurdle of trusting a host with their brand message. When Coca-Cola or Geico is so used to having their gecko in their ads, mm-hmm. and I'm not going to put the gecko on our ads, so it will just be the host talking about it. Like that's a leap for them to take. And once they heard just how long some of these DR folks had been in the space, you're like, well, I guess this is working, right?
Yeah, and I think when it works, it works fantastically well for them. If you can line up the right host with the right product, then it's great. We had we were doing a campaign last year for Spike TV. It was a branding tuning campaign for a documentary season the Jay-Z and the Weinstein Company were behind about Khalif Browder, and being able to kind of connect that show to the hosts of some of our kind of true crime shows was just a fantastic way for them to run that campaign. So again, I think you can kind of get beyond that challenge and when you have the right people on the network.
You've made, I think, 10 original shows so far.
Yeah.
You launched your first originals, I believe, nearly a year to the day as we're recording this, in July 2017.
Yes.
How do you figure out what shows make sense for Audioboom, and how do you figure out like what the economic viability is before you launch them?
Yeah, so we've learned a lot in that past year, and I think to start with, it was we were in an odd place where we were doing this without a really kind of defined budget. So we weren't sitting there and saying this is $15,000 to develop this show, and this is another $30,000 to go and market this show.
Right.
It was let's see what we can do here. And if we have a good idea, we'll make it. And we won't worry too much about making money out of this, in season one or season two. Let's go with some good ideas first and kind of get the creative process up and running. Then we'll take a look at the economics further down the line, which I'm sure a lot of people will tell me is not the best way to do this. But I think,
I don't think anybody knows what the best way is to do this.
Certainly from a creative perspective, that's worked. And we were also very open to lots of different arrangements with for our original content network. So, I call this our O&Os, our owned and operated shows. the reality is, out of our 10 shows, I think we fully own and operate 10 of them. Another bunch, we have, you know, a co-production deals where sure. We are providing production talent, and you know, someone else is bringing the idea to the table, and we're funding you know, that production. And then there are others where we have shows that are just looking for marketing, because they have the show, they have the idea, they're capable of creating that show, but they can't get that out to an audience. Right. So Audio Boom comes in and acts as the, you know, as the platform for distribution and put the marketing spend behind that to kind of make money. As we go forward, you know, that making money does become a big part of this. So
companies love doing that.
Yeah, yeah. And which is odd, because at the BBC, we never had to make money. We just got given a big check every month to go and make some creative programming.
So it's nice work if you
yeah,
can get it.
Yeah, it doesn't, you don't get that in many places, but definitely there. But you know, we've learned a lot now. We have, you know, we have a set budgets now to go with the development. We know what a 10 or 15 or 30 or $50,000 promotional budget can, what level of audience that can bring to the show. You learn that very quickly, and therefore you know how you need to spend that money, where you need to spend it, and downstream, you know, what your expectations and revenue are kind of coming back. So you can get pretty detailed on it and yes. and get a great understanding of you know, what your spend is and what you're going to get in coming back to you in season one, season two, and beyond.
And what's, I mean, and Nick Kwa, since I know you're listening, this is another potential pull quote after the penis stuff. But the other thing that I am increasingly not surprised by it, but I guess I have to remind myself over and over again, is that it's becoming a lot more like the App Store was, where initially when you launched podcasts, when you launched apps, there weren't that many of either. So you could stand out in the crowd without having to do that much. But now with hundreds of thousands of shows, I'm not even talking about the discoverability problem per se. It's just that it's hard for any one show to stand out, even in moderate success. Predicting how big an audience is going to be is tricky. And if it was, if there was a one-stop shop plan for how you could promote a show, what the marketing plan is to make a show be a hit, everybody would do it. And so that's the exciting part to me of the work that both you and I are looking at, is how do you plan a show? How do you decide what the budget is for a show, and how do you launch that show? And you're gambling on what the audience is going to be. Are you going to be able to hit that size and make it be a show that's, you know, worth having done?
Yeah. I mean, I think who knows whether there'll ever be an organic hit podcast again?
Right.
Probably not right at this stage. If you look at the, you know, anything new that hits that top 20, there's marketing spend behind that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's becoming a real business, you know, at this point. You know, and it matches.
My guess is there'll still be sleeper hits that come in that are just folks who are going independent and doing a thing. Like My Favorite Murder was effectively that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that'll keep happening, but I think you're right that they're gonna be very much the exception.
Yeah. You know, I think there's very kind of clear comparisons now with the TV industry here in the US, right? It's nothing connects, very little connects unless there's a huge marketing spend behind it. And you know, and where you spend that money and how you spend it is a real gamble.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the listeners are tuning in part for your insights, in part because they want to know what the hell is going on with Triton. So let's pause here. We're going to do a quick ad break. I don't know if Audio Boom or Midroll sold these ads, but whichever they are, we're going to read them right now, and we'll be back right after this. I want to tell you about a great new show called Gossip that's out now from Stitcher. Gossip is the first ever comedic soap opera podcast created by actor and comedian Alison Raskin, who's also a New York Times bestselling author, the co-creator of the Just Between Us YouTube channel. Gossip stars three unlikely friends, Valerie, Mia, and Bethany. They meet up each week at the Golden Cup Coffee Corner to dish about the latest rumors floating around about their not-so-traditional suburban town, Golden Acres. There's infidelity, epic fights, crazy sisters, former bachelorettes, girls going missing, and murder. Maybe even a serial killer priest. Reminds me of my childhood. If you're a fan of shows like Jane the Virgin, Desperate Housewives, or Big Little Lies, you will love Gossip. Plus, there are special appearances from Earwolf favorites like John Gabris and Tawny Newsom, but apparently no role for Lex Friedman. Whatever. Get in on the rumors now before you're left out. Listen to episodes 1 and 2 of Gossip now on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your shows. All right, we are back with Stuart Last, Chief Operating Officer at Audio Boom. And right before the break, I was just teasing that we were going to talk Triton. So my limited, poor understanding of this is you were going to do what some have termed a merger or a reverse merger, an acquisition, reverse something, some kind of combination with Triton. What was it going to be? It didn't happen. why not?
Yeah, so
that's all. That's my only question.
The technical part is, you know, Audioboom is a publicly traded company on one of the UK stock exchanges. Triton, privately owned company.
Here in the US,
but Triton obviously probably a 5 or 6 times bigger than Audioboom. So in order to bring the companies together, Audioboom had to be the company that actually bought Triton. But because Triton is bigger than Audioboom, it technically becomes a reverse takeover. Cutting through all of that, the idea behind this was to merge the two companies and just create a full digital audio company.
What did Triton offer that Audioboom was excited about?
I think the bit that we were kind of most excited about was what Triton does in terms of data and analytics and metrics for the radio industry and the streaming industry.
Yep.
And being able to bring that over into the podcast space with Audioboom's expertise in podcast and kind of attached, because, you know, the industry is crying out for measurement services, for data to give back to advertisers. We're a long way from having everything we need, but having someone like Triton being able to concentrate on building that out, using Audioboom and our relationships and our connections around the industry to bring all the other players into their methodology, I think was pretty exciting for us.
And you said it had to be that way for various reasons that you had acquired them versus the other way around. Because in theory, with Triton's size and Audioboom size, it might have been easier for them to work up the funds to acquire you, yeah?
Yeah, I think that getting the access to capital to buy Audioboom is tougher if you're a privately owned company. If you're publicly listed, accessing capital is supposed to be easier, but not in this case. You know, the capital was not accessed to buy Triton, and the deal, as you know, fell through.
And so, why do you think that is? Why were you unable to raise the funds?
I think it was, it was a toughish sell to investors. You know, Audioboom is, although smaller and although still in more of a startup phase, is an easier sell to investors. Hence the latest round of fundraise that Audioboom just did, coming in pretty quickly, because Audioboom is, like I said, is a content company. It is growing really quickly. You're able to create some kind of, deeper and emotional engagement for investors. And I think we think that they are just about numbers, and that's not always the case, especially when it comes to content. Raising $180 million, which is a huge amount of money in this space, to do the Triton deal, is tough. If you are just talking about, data and analytics to people, I think giving them an understanding of content and programming just, is that extra connection that people need in order to put the money in.
Got it. And so what are the consequences of it not happening? Obviously, you guys were interested. You and Triton had clearly been talking about this for some time. You believe it's going to happen and then it doesn't. Like, what's the downside?
Yeah, I mean, the process was kind of delayed because we gave it every chance that we could to happen. And the terms of the deal kind of kept changing on both sides to try and get this through, to try and make it work. And, the delay in doing that just meant for Audioboom that we kind of hit this bad place in terms of cash flow. Coming in that overall Triton deal was additional cash to grow Audioboom's side of the operation. Audioboom needed funding, probably needed funding as far back as December of last year to take that next accelerated growth step. But while we were in that Triton transaction, we couldn't, taken any other funding because we were already in this. So
were the media reports accurate that there was only sufficient working capital for a period of 4 weeks back in May?
In terms of the money in the bank account today, pretty close.
Got it.
But that's, internally, we also have that knowledge that, we have X $100,000 coming in from this advertising agency expected in the next 2 weeks, this amount of money coming in here. So there was a longer kind of runway than that. But, I'm not going to lie to you. It got pretty kind of crazy. It was, one of the toughest few months of my working career.
I can imagine.
And, the worst thing was we, we kind of let down a lot of our partners. We fell behind on partner payments because, you know, with a limited cash flow, you have to decide where to put that. You got to keep the company running because you know you're going to get out the other side. And when you get out the other side, you know you're going to get people paid.
Did the shows know? Were they, or how much were you able to keep them in the loop?
We were able to talk to them about, you know, this transaction affecting their payments. The frustrating thing is, you know, especially at kind of, you know, day-to-day operational level that me and my team are in, we had not a lot more than that. We didn't know when the transaction was either going to close or we would withdraw from that transaction. So giving people a timeline was pretty tough. We at no point were we able to say, you will be paid this amount of money on this date, this amount on this date, and then we'll have you fully caught up here. You know, the communication was difficult, you know, but no excuses. You know, we should not have put any of our partners into that position whereby their finances are affected to the point of, you know, them not knowing whether they can operate for the next month or create content for the next month because, you know, we haven't paid them for 6 weeks.
Now, you mentioned you just raised another $6 million. And so are you caught up on payments to podcasters now?
We are. We're not fully caught up. So as soon as we were able to withdraw from the Triton deal, you know, that instantly gave us a better look at our cash flow. We caught up 70 of our shows immediately. We made partial payments to over 100 more at that point. We raised the funds last week and we were able to announce that. That money doesn't come in immediately. So it's not a case of we've raised the money, tomorrow you will get paid. It'd be nice if it was. So that money comes in stages over the next 3 to 6 weeks. And obviously paying partners is just a kind of a high, very high priority there. We expect to have everyone fully caught up, you know, early to mid July.
Got it. Okay. And there were quotes I think were given to Nick Kwa, second mention in the show. He's going to be very proud. That Audioboom now is a belief. I think this is from Rob Proctor, CEO, that you could run a tighter, more compact operation, which will ultimately lead to a stronger, more vibrant business. What does it mean for you to be tighter and more compact?
Yeah, I think this is a kind of a quote that was, I don't say misunderstood a little across the industry. So some of our partners, many of the influencers, kind of picked up on this, and it was kind of widely viewed that we were saying here that we were no longer going to be working with smaller podcasts, and that what we actually needed to, well, all that we were going to focus on were kind of, you know, tier one podcasts for ad sales, because, you know, it's easier to work with a small group that each bring in a big amount of revenue. That's not what we are kind of doing here. That quote was really about our legacy relationships with our radio partners. So kind of back at the start of this, we were talking about what Audioboom used to be. It used to be this platform for on-demand radio. So we work with radio stations kind of globally, loads, a bunch in Australia, in the UK. Here in the US, we were working with Cumulus and Westwood One, two of the biggest radio groups. And so we were platforming tens of thousands of on-demand audio channels, podcast channels, essentially, whereby the radio stations would just take their programs, flip them into an on-demand format and distribute them. You know, that took a lot of management, had a lot of tech cost behind it, and, you know, not a lot of income because of it. Because, again, it's, you know, really all you can do is run programmatic, $2 CPM advertising across it, right?
And it doesn't really feel like it's not podcast specific in any way.
Exactly that. So, you know, didn't really kind of grow as a medium, because I think that's a separate medium to original content podcasting, and just took a lot of resource from the team. Those relationships are kind of have come to the end. Many of them have kind of lived the life of the contract at this point, and Audioboom, you know, isn't and our radio partners, you know, are not re-upping those agreements. So it means we can shift that resource away from those thousands and thousands of channels and then concentrate on two or three things, really, which is, you know, our premium ad sales network of 200 top shows, and then our services for those smaller podcasts. And so, you know, we're definitely not stepping away from working with those small shows. We have a really great hosting package that enthusiast or creator level podcasters can pay $10 a month for, which is probably best value on the market right now. We have, like I said, we have that automated ad network that, again, shows that are not big enough to attract live read or host endorsed ads can kind of tap into and make a small amount of money that way. We have some other kind of services launching. We have a merch store launching in the coming months or so.
You should have partnered with us on that, but it's fine. I get it.
You were there well before us.
We could still help if you haven't gone too far. Yeah. I will tell you, the thing that I love, it's not really a pitch for mid-roll services here, but with Pod Swag, which is what we do merch, is, you know, we hired a woman who used to run like Guess and like the fashion line for all their like fulfillment and warehousing and all those things. And she came and she's like, we're not going to do on-demand printing anymore, right? Your podcasts are on-demand. Your merch should not be. If you want to get like the highest quality stuff, and you're going to print and you're going to warehouse and you're going to figure out what the volume demand is going to be. And like, so when we do it, it's not like and we love these companies, but it's not like, you know, the Cotton Bureaus of the world or even a lot of these other, you know, podcasters who do it one-off where it's like, let's print up 50 shirts or let's pre-order. And then once we have them, we'll sell. Like, We have a warehouse space across the country that's full of our stuff. And so when people ship, we ship every day of the week and we get it there. And like, anyway, my only point is, if you haven't gone too far down the path, I'm happy to help. We're just doing business deals on the Wolf Den now. That's what we do.
Yeah, we can do that. I think, I think we are probably too far down there. And I think we've gone the other way. So we are doing this on demand and we are doing it kind of risk-free for the podcasters again.
I get it.
You know, I think this is one of those things that by doing it on demand and risk-free, that's the only way to do this for our big shows that have millions of built-in audience.
Get it.
And you know, Bob, who has a paranormal show that he records in his bedroom and has 150 hardcore listeners that are there every week in, week out, he can now still sell t-shirts or hoodies to that audience of 150 without any kind of risk attached. So I think—
As long as they're not all wearing antimicrobial Mac Weldon gear. Not a paid endorsement.
Who is not wearing Mac Weldon gear in the podcast space?
Literally,
at the moment.
My polo and my jacket are both Mac Weldon.
Yeah, I'm in socks.
All my socks and boxers too. Well, now you know what I'm wearing, listeners. My pants are from The Gap. I don't know if that's true. But listen, I want to only talk to you and only talk about Audioboom, but there are other listeners who get to correspond with us as well because we have a fairly new feature here. In fact, the only feature on The Wolf Den that includes its own theme song. It's when we open up our mailbag. It is time for The Wolf Den Mailbag.
Wolf Den Mailbag. Don't be happy, don't be sad. Now just sit back and enjoy this week's Wolf Den Mailbag.
Pause for laughter. My God, it's so good. Okay, so this week's mailbag question comes from Seth Dalby, who says, the IAB podcast revenue study came out recently. Hey, you were talking about this before we started recording. The IAB podcast revenue study came out recently. Were you surprised by the IAB study? Did you think the industry had grown more than that? Stuart, you saw the IAB, which said it's, what, I think somewhere around 320...
314, I think it was.
$314 million business in 2017. And that's... a bunch of member companies that participated with the IB and PricewaterhouseCoopers that do the study, and then they say, well, we had maybe 80% of the industry, so there's other people who've also whatever. What do you think of the numbers? Do you think we would have grown more?
No, I think 2017 was pretty much as expected. I think everyone knew it was above the 225 figure that they first projected it at originally. So I think that 314 number is pretty spot on. I think that was, 86% growth year on year, which... is good. You know, again, happy to be like ahead of that curve, which is good in our growth. But yeah, you know, that feels right. The part
roughly
for me,
$300 million of that is mid roll. Just kidding.
Wow, we're you guys are just doing even better than I thought.
I'll take it withdrawn. Yes, Joe.
So that bit, I think, was, you know, pretty expected. I think the bit that you know troubled me somewhat was the forward projections, which I believe is 28% year on year for the next 3 years. I figure that's a little low.
Oh, I agree. I think it's low. I think the estimates were going to be somewhere. I don't have the numbers in front of me, which because I didn't know this question, Seth. I'm sorry, but I think they had the estimate somewhere in the 700 to 800 million by 2020. I think it'll be a billion by 2020. I'll say the things that I thought were interesting were. DAI is slightly decreasing over time. Mm-hmm. Midroll was really, really slow to embrace dynamic ad insertion, mostly because I was like, we should keep baking in for as long as possible. Not because I want to give lots of extra value to advertisers, although who doesn't? But because I like when the hosts can super organically segue into the ads. I think that's really effective and impactful, even with the greatest, most seamless insertion. I wanted to be cautious there. And it's interesting to me to see
you know when
less.
You hear it, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I also don't know. I don't know exactly what the number means. Steve Wilson from Apple was tweeting at Bill Irwin, who works here, because Bill Irwin had tweeted about the study. And Steve was like, well, there's a lot of big podcast companies that make a lot of money that weren't included in that study. I don't know who he was thinking about, somebody who has Steve Wilson's ear.
You've seen who was included, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a lot of big companies in there, too. Were you in there?
We were in there.
And so it's basically all the IAB podcast committee member companies, I think. But I don't know. The biggest folks in the space are there. There's absolutely more money than we know, and it's these are known unknowns, right? We have no idea how many dollars are going to the companies that didn't participate. So Steve is right. The number could be even bigger, but I don't see anything that's worrisome to me other than everybody being super cautious about where it's going. Now, some of them are publicly traded companies. All of them have either investors or everybody's got an owner of some kind, whether it's an investor or, you know, corporation, whatever it is. So it's not shocking to me that everybody's saying, oh, we expect our growth will be small because you've got to set expectations. But they're all sandbagging is my take.
Let me ask you a question, I guess.
Is that even allowed? Go ahead.
I don't know, actually. Are we allowed to do that?
Yes.
So with that, you know, with that 28% year-on-year growth, how does that impact your company strategy, I guess, on your end, whereby you are market leader on the ad sales side of things, but you also have a lot of focus on Stitcher and paid for subscribers, right?
Yes.
The non-advertising side, knowing that there's there's this conservative growth projected. Where do you focus, and how does that change, you know, what you guys want to do?
Well, I have to think about how I can answer.
Yeah.
Stitcher Premium is a core part of our business, and the ad sales are a core part of our business. We like the recurrent, predictable revenue stream that Premium offers, and obviously we like what ad sales does. They're both important. They both remain key focuses for us. Right now, to grow Stitcher Premium, you've got a couple moves. You can continue to make great shows and put them in there. You can continue to grow the overall free-to-listen Stitcher audience, which gets more people exposed to Stitcher Premium. And then it's also like literally just marketing dollars on Stitcher Premium, right? If you have great shows, you got to make sure people know about them. Ad sales is bigger, but I mean, all the folks who do premium content in other mediums have success with it. And it's currently beating, or it's at least meeting and sometimes exceeding our expectations. There are frankly times when like we can do a show like Wolverine with Marvel, in part because we've got all the different pieces in play. We know we're going to be able to sell ads against it, and we're going to be able to generate premium revenue from it, and that's a good thing. But it's I don't know. I would say that we're pretty excited by both things, and they both remain core focuses for us.
Cool.
There's one last thing we have to do. This has no theme song. We don't like to let people with brains like yours, Stuart, come into the Wolf Den without sharing some advice for our listeners. Is there something that you wish you had known when you first started in podcasting that you want to tell the up-and-coming entrepreneurs today? Like, what's the one piece of advice you give to folks who want to make money in this business?
Who want to make money?
Yeah.
You know, I think the key thing for me is consistency. And that runs through from, like, you know, a company level in terms of the network doing the selling and the tools, but more down to the podcaster itself. Just, you know, make sure you drop episodes the weeks that you're scheduled to drop episodes. Make sure you know what ads you're supposed to be running that week, because, you know, you start missing ads. That kind of credibility just slowly ebbs away, and long term just doesn't allow you to kind of grow your podcast or your business. So I think consistency around advertising, you just got to be professional, right? I think, and yes, if you want to make money, you have to see that as a profession. So do what you would do if you were going to work, which is to make sure you do exactly what you have to do.
Well, if you want to be able to get advice from our guests or just have your question come after the Wolf Den mailbag theme song, you got to email us. It's wolfden@midroll.com, or you can tweet it right at me, Lex Fry, L-E-X-F-R-I on Twitter. Where can our listeners follow you online, Stuart?
I am at Stuart Lost on Twitter, mainly Twitter. I do a lot of Instagram. I should do more.
I don't know if I'm following you on Twitter.
I don't know if I'm following you. We should do that.
Stuart, hang on. I'm going to see if it's true. Yeah. Listeners, I'm going to tell you in real time, is that really his name on Twitter? The answer is yes, and I'm now following him. He's a New Yorker via London, via Ipswich. That's me. The 80s, a golfing nut, a music fan, plus the COO at Audio Boom.
I followed you right back.
At the same time as Podcast Movement.
Yeah, pretty much.
Are you going to be able to go to Podcast Movement?
Honestly, I miss it every year.
Because always babies.
No, I have never been to Podcast Movement, which is kind of crazy. 2015, first baby arrived in August, right at the same time as Podcast Movement. 2016, don't remember what I was doing. Last year, I was in the UK. I was our company's annual general meeting, so I was there. I do know what I was doing in 2016. I was in the UK again doing some work with the UK government. So every single year, there's been a reason that I've had to miss it, and this will be no different. So one day, I will get there.
Had the show not opened with repeated dick jokes, I would be willing to say right now that when Marc Maron goes to the bathroom, he also calls that a podcast movement. But I can't do multiple juvenile jokes, so I got to let that one go. But Stuart, thank you so much for your time. Thanks to Harry Nelson and Jared O'Connell. The Wolf Den mailbag theme is by Casey Holford. Lyrics by Harry. Subscribe to The Wolf Den at earwolf.com, on Stitcher, or on Apple Podcasts. Please rate us in whatever app you use. Stuart, thank you. And listeners, we'll see you next time right here on The Wolf Den.
Want to hear Earwolf pilots before anybody else? We made a podcast feed just for you. Earwolf Presents is full of great stuff, like preview episodes for upcoming shows, peeks behind the paywall, and pilots for podcasts that haven't even been made yet. It's like getting to listen in behind the scenes here at Earwolf. Starting January 21st, Earwolf Presents will have a bunch of new pilots for you, like Edgar Montplaisir's The Wokest. Catch conversations between the wokest man in the world and comedians like Reza Lechea. Also, hear upcoming pilots The Florida Cast, Wow, You're Native American Too?, This Week in Sports, and Carl Alarm all throughout the month. Let us know what you think of them with hashtag Earwolf Presents. Subscribe to Earwolf Presents to hear more great episodes from around the network and behind the paywall, like an episode of Drew Tarver's Strictly Business with Derek Contrera, or Act One of Matt Besser's punk musical, Stolen Idea. Just search for Earwolf Presents in your podcast app and subscribe so you don't miss an update.